Good afternoon. I'll call to order the meeting of the State Government Budget Division for February 9th, 2009. By the way, on February 9th, happy birthday, Senator Jung Bauer. It's your birthday today. So.
Thank you.
We have a couple of items on the agenda today. We'll start with the Campaign Finance and Disclosure Board. Obviously, it's a board that at least the members have interaction with. Mr. Goldstein, welcome to the Budget Division. You'll need to identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gary Goldsmith. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board.
And go ahead. We are focusing on, Mr. Goldsmith, as we've been going through the agencies, we do have the budget books here. It's a fairly short area, but of course the governor has been proposing a 5% reduction in the agencies, and so if you could indicate, you know, what that means to your agency, and you did provide some handouts to the committee. We have them before, so
okay.
Please proceed.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Senators, first of all, thank you for allowing me to testify this afternoon. This is my just the beginning of my second year as Executive Director of the Campaign Finance Board, so I haven't been before this committee before. I've been with the board previously from 1995 through 2000, so some of you may have heard me testify during that period when we were developing our campaign finance software. Just a few brief words about the board itself. You probably all know, since you've had some relationship with us, even if it's just filing a report, but you probably know that this is a board of six citizens, all appointed by the governor, of mixed partisan makeup. No more than three can support one party. It's the only board that whose members are approved by both the Senate and the House. And the reason for that, I think, is that this board has oversight, of course, over each legislator as well as the constitutional officers and other candidates in the state. So it's really a board not of the governor but of the state government itself, and we consider ourselves really to be a board of the people. The board is responsible for several programs, a couple of minor ones that you probably aren't typically involved in, at least in any big sense, are economic interest. You do file an annual statement with us, disclosure of conflict of interests. But the programs that take up the most of the board's resources are the lobbying program, which is primarily a reporting and disclosure program, and finally the campaign finance program. And that's by far the biggest one because it's the most complicated part of the statute. It consists of components of administration, regulation, and, of course, disclosure. And at a very minimum, you've each filed reports with the campaign finance board, so you know about the disclosure, you know something about the regulations that are all statutory, and about the board's role in obtaining that disclosure, making it public, and ensuring compliance with the regulations. Over the years, and particularly over the last year since I've been executive director, we've been doing things to help become more efficient with the idea of reducing our staff ultimately in overall numbers, making our operations more efficient, and, of course, dealing with a budget situation that we knew was coming for this biennium, but we're actually working on the situation that we expect to see for the next biennium, which is certainly going to be a difficult one as well. What we've already done, several of you use our campaign finance software reporting program called Campaign Finance Reporter. That is a very valuable tool allowing candidates to keep track of their financial transactions and easily generate and send a report to the board, which is in correct format. It also serves one of the board's big goals, which is to make compliance easier, because with that tool, if you do something that's going to result in a violation, when you file your report, the software will tell you in time to correct that violation. It also makes the board's operations more efficient because data that we would hand enter from a paper report can be moved directly into our databases for other activities automatically without doing that data entry. We have moved our economic interest supplemental reporting system totally online, so somewhere in the high 90% of people annually when they need to review their economic interest statement, they go online with a username and password, and they don't have to do anything if it hasn't changed. They can certify it that it's the same, or they can make changes. Likewise, with our lobbying program, we were able to move that whole disclosure program online so that lobbyists now, rather than filing a paper report, again, in the upper 90s, about 97% of lobbyists file their report just by going to the website and filling in the blanks on the web page. We've also made public access much more efficient and easier, saving the public well over $10,000 a year in expenses they would pay out of their pockets to access board data. And I can verify that figure because we were able to eliminate a big photocopy machine in the front office at a cost of about $8,000 a year, which we recovered by charging people for photocopying. So that was an $8,000 savings, not to the state directly to the board, but to the citizens of the state. And then when you add the fact that each of those people had to come to the board's office to drive and park, certainly the citizens save over $10,000 by putting all those reports online. And we've, in fact, removed that copier, and they still have access, if they need it, to the copier that staff uses. When I came on board a year ago, actually in December a year ago, I thought that the finances were going to be excellent. The previous executive director was leaving, and the new executive director would make somewhat less money, so there should be a cushion. Other things were happening. And it turned out that already the budget shortfalls were creeping up on the board. Each year, we have been lucky to get some sort of increase, typically in the 3% range, for increases in salaries. And each year, salaries go up. Salaries and benefits were going up about 6 or 7%, because most of our staff are not at their salary cap, so they would get their annual step increase. All but two are union members. The two management staff, I and the assistant director, are in the managerial plan. So they would get an annual step, and then they would get a cost of living increase under the contract, so typically 6%. So the budget shortfall was becoming visible, and it became obvious to me that I wasn't going to be able to immediately fill what would have been our ninth staff position. Back when we had the complement system in the 90s, and actually in through the early 2000s, I think it lasted. When we released a new version of Campaign Finance Reporter in 2000, we were approved for a ninth staff member under the complement system. And really, that's the number of staff members that were at that time optimum to run the board's operations. We've been able to move away from that number somewhat. The board recommendation for the legislature for this biennium is that we have funding for between 8 and 8.5 staff members. Actually, the budget that I'm proposing to the legislature would fund us at 8 staff members. So we've been able to reduce one full staff position by the things that we've done through technology. It's primarily all through our technology increases. The first thing I did when I came in was to look at our staff complement, and we had a receptionist. We only had one information technology position where we had normally had two. And I restructured the staff to eliminate the front office or front desk position. We went to an interactive voicemail system provided by Office of Technology, OET, which, as you know, you press a number to get through to who you want. We've structured our documents to use direct numbers so that people can reach staff more directly. And by doing that, I was able then to fund once again that second information technology position. These two positions are critical because everything we do is driven by technology. So now we're operating with 8 staff at the moment. We have funding for about 8.4, but because if I were to fill that position and then not have ongoing funding, we would incur unemployment costs at the end of the fiscal year, which we couldn't fund. So we're holding that position open until we know what's going to happen at the legislature. We are working with the legislature to further make our operations efficient and to do the few cost-saving things that we can identify. Our budget is approximately, typically it's been 89% staff salaries. With the proposed reduced budget, it's going to be more like 80 to 85% staff salaries. But we're looking at some other things. For example, in our budget, in the board's bill to the legislature this year, for the first time, we're asking that campaign committee treasurers and candidates be required to provide an email address if they're able to do that. There's an opt-out provision that they can use. Right now, we can't require them to get email addresses, and that's a first step in being able to electronically deliver a lot of the informational materials that we now deliver by paper. we don't want to just stop sending things like notices of limits and notices of new statutes and so on, because our goal really isn't to meet the minimum that the board has to do. Our goal is to get voluntary compliance. We find that compliance is there when it's voluntary and the people understand. So we have to continue to get the message out as to what's required and what's expected. We will be able to move to an electronic system once we get a bank of email addresses, and we want to implement a system where when we send an email address out, the treasurer can click a link to confirm receipt. We don't want to run into the problem that we see even with mail, where treasurers and others that we serve, when they make a mistake, say, we didn't know, we didn't get the notice from the board. And, of course, email has a tremendous potential for saying, I never got it and I never saw it. So we want to let them know, but we want to make sure they actually get the message. We also have a proposal in our bill to eliminate one certified letter out of the two that are now required at the end of a year to get a report or to trigger costs of not filing a report. Right now, on the fourth day after a report is due at the end of the year, this is not pre-primary or pre-general, a late filing fee can accrue. It's very minimal, $5 a day, only up to $100. But even for that, we have to send a certified letter. We already do telephoning, and we're proposing that this certified letter be eliminated and just allow us to continue our telephoning. Our staff estimated that that would save us sending out 1,700 certified letters in a typical year with a cost savings of at least $1,700, actually probably more than that. And with our small budget of only about $100,000 for operating expenses, that's actually a significant amount. There's also a proposal to make electronic filing mandatory for the elections in 2012. Now, that does not mean that you would have to use our software. It means you would have to file your report in an electronic format that we will publish. And we have a multi-prong approach in development right now. One would be to continue, of course, the software, so that would be applicable, but also to devise an open standard that other vendors could use, that people who are skilled in Excel could use, possibly even to develop a set of spreadsheets that would meet our criteria. So that's an activity or an initiative that we're bringing forward with the hope that at some future point we will be able to bring our staff level down even from that 8 that we're seeking to fund at this point. One of my biggest goals when I became executive director, and one of the things I noticed right away, was that all of our customer service was being done on a one-to-one basis. We would get the same call over and over. Even though we publish handbooks and we do some training, we would still get the same calls over and over again, and we didn't have an electronic knowledge base. We didn't have online tutorials. We don't have online video training or anything like that. And I wanted to move us to more of an education-based model. We've done training in outstate Minnesota, but because of our limited funds and the size of the state and the way treasurers and candidates are spread out, we would get sometimes two or three, and we concluded that we couldn't continue to send a staff member out for two or three people. But if you move those things online, then they're available when people want them, and everybody will have access. And so that's one of our goals. It does take staff to do that, but once you do it, then the need for staff decreases. So our goal for fiscal 10-11 is to fund 8 staff and hopefully then maybe 7.5 after that, either the next biennium or the biennium after that, when the mandatory financing, campaign finance filing would kick in if that's passed. The board is responsible, and I'm going to work a little bit now from the white spreadsheet that you've been handed out. This is quite similar.
Before I get there, Mr. Gross, yes. Senator Lumbergh, I just had a question here.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Sir, I came in a little late, and you were talking about perhaps the board was planning on requiring an electronic registration.
Filing.
Filing.
Filing is mandated.
Had there been any discussion about the possibility that perhaps some candidate somewhere in the state may not have the funds to even pay for a computer. Would
sure. Yes, the bills that are circulating, there's one now, I think there will be another one, allow the board to grant an opt-out of that for good cause. My discussions with the board and at staff, and this is not would not be effective till 2012 election year, so there's a lead-up period. But our feeling is that there are a couple of things we see. One is treasurers are a valuable commodity. They're hard to get, and it's hard to get a good one. And if you get a good one and you've had that treasurer for a long time and that treasurer doesn't want to learn to use a computer, I don't think it's up to the board to say you have to get a new treasurer or they have to learn. That would be a situation, I think, where we would allow that treasurer to continue to file the way they filed before if we couldn't facilitate a transition. But there are lots of treasurers who have computers, are computer savvy, have high-speed internet, and simply maybe say, you know, I don't want to learn. That might be a more difficult situation. Also, with very small committees where the learning curve for some electronic system might not be worth it, they would be able to opt out as well.
And just knowing that this was coming up, I just informally checked in because I wanted to figure out where is the members of the budget division going to be, you know, in discussing this issue. And half of the members file electronically and half do not. So I'm just, you know, so I can kind of figure out how's that representative for the overall candidate universe, people filing it or not filing paper versus electronically? How does that, do you have any?
Sure, Mr. Chairman, members. For the last election, which was just House of Representatives, but this is fairly typical for each election, about 50% of the candidates who actually file for office use the software. The numbers drop for political committees and funds and party units.
Okay, so budget division is representative of that universe. Senator Rust.
Along that line, and Senator Limmer, that the board's bill has been introduced. It's Senate File 425, and I welcome your evaluation of the proposals that are in there. Some of them are technical, like he's explained at the beginning, but that's a significant one. I'm more interested in new candidates. So 50% of the people who ran for office in 2008 among the legislative candidates used the campaign software. What is the percentage of those who were running for the first time use of that? I mean, is it a growing number? Is it mostly incumbents who have been in for 20 years who are not using the campaign finance software? Do the newer ones, regardless of where they are in the state, do they tend to use it? What is your experience with candidates that are filing for the first time or maybe even their first reelection?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Senator Rest, Mr. Chairman, members, I don't have the actual figures, but it's a good question because we have looked at it in a more informal way in the office, and I think I will have staff look at those figures, but I can tell you what I believe they will show, and I believe that they will show that a significantly higher percentage of new candidates coming into the system who are, in fact, serious candidates, not people who have no ability to raise money, but actual serious candidates, a significantly higher percentage of those candidates opt into the software right away.
Mr. Chairman, I think that would speak to the issue of, you know, long-term treasurers that don't want to change, but if the brand new candidates are taking that up, then I think it is a good move as long as the board has some discretion in for whatever reason, but for good cause, I think is what the legislation says, to allow that not to happen. You indicate that you think that when that would get, I don't know, fully done, but that your FTE need would go down. Can you put a number on that? What kind of cost savings would you anticipate, or is it too early to anticipate that for the requirement for electronic filing in whatever format, open or campaign finance software?
Okay, Mr. Goldsmith?
Senator Rest, Mr. Chair, members, My estimate at this point is about 0.5 FTE. That would primarily be the staff that do data entry and manual visual review of reports. We don't actually data enter expenditures at this point. We never have. We simply do not have the staff to do them. And the violations for campaign finance for candidates are typically, well, the statute makes the violations mostly related to receipts, so we enter the receipts. We do a visual inspection of every report, though, for expenditure-type violations. All of that would be eliminated, or most of it, based on, depending on how many waivers are given, but most of that would be eliminated. Additionally, I think that what we're doing is developing better technology systems to audit and examine reports even now, and by 4 years from now that will be fairly well perfected, so that a lot of what's being done now manually will be automated as far as looking at potential violations and even generating letters regarding those violations. So my goal would be 0.5.
Sir Rush.
You know, one of the things that happens, whether it's things are filed electronically or not, is the ability to audit those reports. And I don't mean sending a letter to somebody and saying you put this down as a non-campaign expenditure and it should have been a campaign expenditure, but actually auditing, quote, the books, and in particular of randomly at least requiring the final report for the year to be reconciled against a candidate's bank balance, and that to the extent that, frequently we hear that they're off by a couple hundred dollars because they can't figure out what happened to it. But it would seem to me that we would get better reporting as well and better attention to the accounting that goes on if at some point, if there were savings anywhere else, that those random audits could be done and with some sort of standard that that there would be a forgiveness of up to $200 difference, but beyond that there has to be some explanation about why a year-end bank balance reconciled is different and how different from the campaign finance report that is filed. And as I understand it now, you don't do that at all. Is that correct?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, members, essentially that is correct. In certain rare occasions when a committee is supposed to terminate under statute and they request to stay active, we do ask them to prove that they still have the money that they claim they have. That's a very limited situation.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Goldsmith, that might be the place to start with these rather than active candidates. The ones that are terminating, their bank balance ought to indicate what their year-end balance is on their report.
Mr. Goldsmith.
Yes, Senator Rest, Mr. Chair, members. We have noticed, just because a couple of committees have come forth voluntarily, that there is a problem. We don't know the scope of it. We completed one audit of a committee last year that was about $6,000 short. We're in the process right now of auditing a committee that is more like $60,000 short, not a candidate committee, a PAC, so that there's but it's a serious situation. We do think that we've homed in on it more or less to a year when they had two bank accounts and only reported going out of one when they left all the other expenditures off, and that would solve most of their problem. I think our approach to that is going to be first to start notifying all committees in our materials that it's important that these two figures do reconcile, your reported balance and your actual cash balance in the bank, and get them started thinking about that, and then at some point start a program where they can do workouts with the board if there's a significant difference. We certainly are aware of it, and we know it's something that we need to work on, and it is the first step toward auditing, is just to get the balances in reconciliation.
Any other questions on this point? Okay, well, please proceed.
Okay. Turning to the white spreadsheet that says the cost of political campaign public subsidy in Minnesota, this follows generally the governor's figures in the budget book, but it's actually more accurate and includes some additional cost, because I wanted to review with this committee the whole cost of public subsidy and, in fact, of campaign finance. Now, I say campaign finance. This actually includes the board's full operating budget, so you have lobbying and the other smaller programs in there as well. At the top line, we start with the board's operating budget, which in 2009 was $735, and it's going to $698. That's a 5% cut. In the governor's budget book, I think it says on the biennial line 3.7, but that's based on the fact that in 2008 we had a smaller amount. If you base it just on two times what we had in 2009, it's a 5% cut. In addition to the board's budget, there are a few other things that go into the total cost of public subsidy, and I think this is important because, as I said, the board's main program is campaign finance. The board sees itself as a watchdog over this money, not for the purpose of making sure all the regulations are enforced, which of course is important, but because this is public money in one of two ways. Either it's public money appropriated by the legislature directly to be dispersed to candidates, or indirectly through the contribution refund program, or it's public money because it's money given by the public to these candidates and other committees. So however you look at it, it doesn't start out as their money. They raise it and they get it in various ways. But people, I think the public and I think the legislature, looks to the board to ensure that this money then is appropriately raised and appropriately spent. So the next line that says open appropriation checkoff program, that is in fact the amount of money that is estimated to arise from the checkoff on the tax returns. And this is an indirect appropriation. Actually, it's a direct appropriation. The amount is open because we never know how much will be checked off. And the next line says statutory appropriation. That's a fixed amount, and that's $1,250,000 every election cycle. That makes up most of what you would call the general account payment in your public subsidy account. A portion of the checkoff goes into that as well. So the total public subsidy, and this is the part that's in the board budget, and this is the direct public subsidy paid to candidates and party units as shown on the line. It's about $3.6 million plus $2 million in the off year, so about $3,800,000. And that is in the board's budget. In addition, there's a carry forward in 2011.
Yeah, just a second. Mr. Goldsmith, I think members are trying to figure out, we have the budget books before us, and we have the separate sheet here. And I think your separate sheet is providing some supplemental information, I think, which is not in the governor's budget. The governor's budget, if you look down in the current 2009 and 2011, shows some rather large jumps, you know, in what would be the election years.
Right.
So, and I think that is basically the public subsidy that's paid to the campaigns, and you're providing sort of a more detailed breakdown of that. Is that what this is here?
Mr. Chair, I wish I could say that. Okay. The board did the BBS materials per the instructions, and then after they were all submitted and we had them balanced out, the governor's office redid them, and we didn't agree with the redoing of those figures. In particular, in 2009, under statutory appropriations, 2009, fiscal 09 being an election year, because the election occurs in the first half of 09, under open appropriations, they completely ignore the $1,250,000 that is the statutory appropriation, and they ignore the public subsidy appropriation. So my figures are actually more accurate. I'm working with the governor's office, and in the March forecast, I think these figures will be updated. Likewise, in 2011, our biennial amount is $5,470, and theirs is $6,403. The original figures that the governor's office used were taken from estimates by the Department of Revenue. And because it's in the board budget and we reviewed historical data, the determination was made that these estimates would more appropriately be made by the board. So those figures will go down by about $1 million for each of those years.
Okay, Senator Rust.
So, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Goldsmith, in the governor's supplemental budget, following the March 3rd forecast, we're going to see corrected numbers that reflects the way in which you have come to an agreement about how those numbers should be presented. Is that correct?
Mr. Goldsmith.
With the governor's office.
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, members, that's correct, not only in how we agree that they should be arrived at, but how they should be presented. And I believe that the governor's forecast will look like the spreadsheet that I've provided to you. For example, under miscellaneous statutory revenue, those figures are actually also incorrect. So they will be decreased but accurate in the March submission.
So, Mr. Chairman,
Sarah Rust.
So in 2008, the total dollars sent out on the from the checkoff in the budget in the description before for FY 07-08. Now, does that was $4.8 million. Is that what was sent out during the 08 election cycle, including special elections? Or is it less than that?
The 08 election cycles would have been in the 09 fiscal year.
Correct.
Because it would have been July 1st of 08. Okay. To June 30th of 09. So it's an 09 fiscal year, even though the elections were in calendar year 08.
Okay, so what, and so that figure is how much?
Mr. Goldsmith.
The actual figure?
Yes.
Should be $3,630,000. That's not, does not include contribution refunds. That's the direct payments.
The direct payments.
And that actually, yes, that's the direct payments.
And so, Mr. Chairman, so that's down $1.2 million from the previous election cycle, 07-08, from that $4.8 million, or are those numbers not comparable in terms of the timing?
$4.8 million. Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, I apologize. I don't have the 07-08 figures here in front of me, so if you
I'm looking at your budget page in the budget book, yeah, where it says at a glance.
Oh.
It's on page 2 of the background.
Oh. Yeah, 07, of course, would have included the Senate and the constitutional officers as well, too.
Right. I'm just trying to get the deal here. But the checkoff would be would be down.
Gotcha.
And I want to know if it was that big a drop, or does that represent a different time period to compare to the $3.6 million?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Senator Rest, Mr. Chair, members, it does represent essentially a different time period. If you look on my spreadsheet under 2011, you'll see a carry forward of $1.82 million, and that's the same situation would have happened in the prior election, because this carry forward results from the fact that the Senate and the constitutional officers did not run in the 08 election. So by the result of that, the actual payout in 11 will be quite a bit higher. Mm-hmm. Then it drops back to 3.6 in 013, because everybody will have run for two cycles in a row. So this was a payout figure rather than a budget figure.
So Mr. Chairman, Mr. Goldsmith, there is money held back in the years in which just the House runs, so that in effect they don't get a windfall mm-hmm. from the dollars. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator West, members, that is correct. Under the statute, the $1.25 million per election and the checkoff per election is allocated by a formula among the offices. That formula doesn't change, and any amount not spent because the office was not up carries forward to the next election when that office is up for election.
Didn't understand how that worked. Thank you.
Okay, please proceed.
Great. So the biennial total that's in the board budget estimated for 2011 is $5.67 million. 2013, it drops. That's because there won't be that carry forward. Then there's another component that we actually, we being the board, actually watch over as well, and that's the contribution refund program. We monitor that in two ways. One, of course, is we make sure that people have a valid signed public subsidy agreement before they participate in that program. We coordinate with the Department of Revenue as to who has a valid public subsidy agreement. And once we submit that information to Revenue, then they can issue, the candidate can issue contribution refund receipts. The other reason the board thinks this is important from its perspective is, again, because all of this money flows into candidate and party unit committees. And so, again, it's another source of public money that someone needs to watch over as far as is it being spent appropriately, and the board is the one that watches over it. So the total cost of public subsidy in Minnesota is somewhere around $16 to $18 million every biennium. I make it clear in my notes that these contribution refund programs are from Revenue, not from us, and I think they're probably over by at least $1 million per year. But still, you're looking at many millions of dollars going into these committees and funds, and the board is responsible for the oversight of that money. So any other questions on that particular component? Otherwise, I'll move on to a little bit more detail, but I won't bore you
okay.
with
it. Go ahead.
Moving on to the colored spreadsheet, this really tells you, compares our budget, current year budget, to the projected budget with a 5% reduction. And our current budget, because we're holding this position open, actually this is a bit pro forma, the top line, number one, office administrative specialist, is being held open at the moment until we know what will happen with the budget. Also in negotiations with the governor's office, we agreed that to help with the fiscal 2009 deficit problem, we would return 1% of our budget to the general fund of the state, so we will be retaining enough to make that return at such time as they ask us to do that.
And how much is that?
1% is only $7,350,
okay.
So it's a gesture rather than, I mean, it isn't going to help the budget that much, but it's, okay. It's something we felt we could do. So we're going from, we should be at 8.5, we're holding for 8.7 in this current year, FTEs. Under the governor's budget, we dropped to 7.3, and I'm sorry, it zeroed out in the next year, but 7.3 FTEs. There's a real significance to that. Everything is going to deteriorate as far as the quality of service and the amount of service that we can perform. I already see it to some extent, just going from 9 to 8. Things take longer, things get done more quickly and not as carefully. We aren't able to provide as much time with each client as we'd like to. We've had to do some things like go to the computer voice answering system, which we recognize as a need. Everybody's done it already. We aren't able to develop the educational programs that we want, the training materials that we want. And it's taken a toll on staff. I mean, we really did have 9 people working full-time. One was not working to full capacity, and that's the one that's not with us anymore, not because of the person, but because of the position. But now we have 8 people doing 8.6 or 8.75 people's work. It's all getting done, but not as well as it was in the past. The addition of the new technology position has helped that. Otherwise, our budget on the operating expenses below the line is almost fixed. We have very little discretionary amounts. Our rent item is primarily rent and parking for board members at board meetings. Our rent is in the Centennial Office Building. It's set by the Department of Administration. The increase there is for two reasons. Number one, we were notified that because they're calculating use of common space and allocating that to agencies, our rent was going up $2,700 for fiscal 10-11, and also we haven't been advised yet as to the actual across-the-board increases, so I did build 3% into that. Our printing budget, if we are able to maintain it, will be for administrative rulemaking. One of the important things the board does and hasn't been able to do for the last few years is administrative rulemaking. And really, administrative rulemaking doesn't make the statute more complicated or harder to comply with. It's designed to make it easier to comply with. If you take a look at the administrative rules, for example, in the economic interest program, it's almost impossible to figure out what you're supposed to do and what you're supposed to report. And as a result, staff has developed a number of positions and answers that we can give to clients, but it would be nice to have that set forth in a clear way so staff has solid authority to do that and people can understand what their requirements are. Likewise, with regard to how you file electronically by fax or otherwise, our administrative rules from several years ago say that a fax report has to be in by 4:30 on the due date. To be honest, there's no basis that we at staff can see for that. If it's in by the due date, by fax or otherwise, it ought to be considered received, just like a postmarked envelope. And so the whole system of electronic filing and electronic verification could use some work. So we'd like to do rulemaking probably in the next 2 years, both of those years if we can. We need to train our technology staff. We haven't done that for a long time. We are upgrading to a new version of Windows Server. We have an old, unsupported version of NetWare right now. The Office of OET doesn't really like agencies on those old versions of NetWare anymore. Likewise, we run Microsoft Office 2000, and we've been advised by Office of Administrative of Enterprise Technology that we must upgrade to a current version of Office or we can't join the new state mail hub that's in the process of rolling out. So we need, at least our technology staff needs training on these things, and then they can retrain the staff as necessary. Line 34, OET, the biggest bulk of those expenditures, because we don't buy a lot of software anymore, the biggest bulk of those in the next 2 years are on the assumption that we have only 7.3 staff. We will need to hire some temporary data entry staff during those periods that reports are coming in. OET can provide that at $31 an hour, and so there's hours in that line item for that. Postage is something that we're trying to bring down. As you'll see, we have budgeted it going down somewhat, even though postal costs might go up. Some of that is out of our control. For example, last year in the legislative session, a bill was passed that added 800 new public officials in the terms of soil and water conservation district supervisors, watershed district people, and so on. 800 officials that each needed a first-class letter mailed to them advising them of their rights and responsibilities and so on. Something as seemingly simple as that has a lot of repercussions, not the least of which is about $800 more in postage if you think they might need a second letter at some time during the year. They certainly need one letter. Also, technology, our databases had to be restructured and reconfigured and staff retrained to deal with those people. There's a bill this year to add county commissioners and judges. That's another 700 people.
Yeah, Sarah Pappas.
Do you provide fiscal notes then to the committees when they do add people to your workload?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Senator Pappas, Mr. Chair, members, as I mentioned earlier, this is my first year doing this, and I know what fiscal notes are, and I'm not sure if we wait to be asked for one. We have not been asked for one. I am going to be in touch with Representative Hansen, who's the chief author of the House and brought this forward before, to let him know of the problems, and I will certainly be in the committee hearings. If they want a fiscal note, we would certainly do one, but we can work it into our database. It'll be another $700 to $1,000 in postage per year if that one passes.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am noticing that, of course, some years your workload is much, much heavier than others, and you just mentioned that sometimes you can hire temporary staff to come in and assist when reports are coming in. And you know, it's kind of like here in the legislature sometimes. When we're in our interim, our staff is probably not as busy. And it used to be that we had part-time staffers until the economy got difficult and the skill level got a little higher and we weren't able to do it as easily that to bring people in for 5 months at a time. It often caused problems, and so we started having year-round staff that wasn't always as busy as they could have been during the interim, perhaps. And I suspect that happens in your case, too. Election years have got to be extremely busy, and then a non-election year, less busy. And how much temporary staff can you use? How available is it to you? Do they come with the skill set you need if it's mostly data entry, so that you could rely more on them instead of full-time staff?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, members. It's been some years since we've used temporary staff, and when we did, I don't know if they came from the Office of Enterprise Technology. I don't know what their quality is or their skills. All I know is that there's a line item on their price list of services that they can provide. So at least for budgeting purposes, that's what I used. It might be more economical, or you might get better staff somewhere else. And if we are funded at this level, of course, we'll be finding out. The one staff member that was sort of partly surplus is the position that was structured out of our agency. So we had maybe a 25% downtime for that staff member, but that position doesn't exist anymore. So we've already gone from 9 to 8, and we're putting off things. And this budget would, with the enhancement that I propose, would keep us at 8. So we're really down one full staff member already. And I think that from my perspective, and it's pretty good now after a year being back there, there are a lot of things that have been deferred that really need to be done. And each of our staff members is capable of doing those types of things. And specifically, I'm talking about documentation and development of procedures and policies. Too often in our agency, I will go to someone or someone will come to me and say, what do we do in this situation? What's our policy? And the reason I have to do that is because over the years, the documentation of our policies or our positions, internal working policies, went by the wayside when it was too busy to do other things. It's very important to have those kinds of things for two reasons, really. One, it makes staff work more efficiently because they know they don't have to go running around finding what do we do, here's what we do, step, step, step. Secondly, it meets the board's goal of consistent application of the statute. We don't want staff telling one person one thing, and if you call a different staff person, you get a different answer. So I think at the level of 8 staff for the next 2 years for sure, and probably 4, we could keep them fully busy and get 100% value out of them. Now, after that, if electronic filing goes into place, I would see a drop again.
And if it does not go into effect, what are the ramifications if you do not get the authority to move people into electronic filing?
Mr. Chair, I think that we may be able to see a drop anyway. We're working in that direction. A couple of things are pretty critical. One project that we're working on, but it's been sidetracked a little bit by developing a new release of the campaign finance software, is electronic registration for campaign finance committees, candidate committees, PACs, and funds. If you can register electronically and amend your registration electronically, we eliminate a significant amount of work. One staff member would still preview and okay those registrations, but there wouldn't be the data entry. Another one that's actually quite a bit more complicated is the electronic registration of lobbyists. A third one that's not developed yet is entry of the original statement of economic interest electronically. You can update them and supplement, but the original we type in. So with those other technology improvements, we may still be able to drop. And also, even without mandatory electronic filing, we have a lot of outreach going on. We're working with people all the time to increase those numbers, even if it's not mandatory.
Okay. Could you proceed? And we do need to get...
Sure. I'll make it fairly brief then. We have a big copier out front. That's about $8,000 in the total of equipment we do need to provide in our budget for some periodic replacement, probably one PC per year. Otherwise, we're fairly good on equipment. One item that's built into the equipment is the possible or likely need maybe to buy a Macintosh computer. There's a fairly big universe, bigger than you would think, of users out there, Macintoshes, some of whom are successfully using the software with a Macintosh, others who are struggling. And whether it's mandatory or not, we think we ought to support that group of people. And I think that sort of covers the high points. The total operating budget then is about $115,000 plus salaries, so $698,000. What we would be looking for, if the legislature sees a way to find it, is about $50,000 more, which would get us to that eight-member staff for the next biennium. However, the board has taken the position is not going to ask for any money from the general fund beyond what the governor has recommended. So it's been the board's recommendation, and part of the reason why I went over the total cost of public subsidy, it's been the board's recommendation that whatever we need extra, whether it's $50,000 if we stay with $698 in the budget, or more if that $698 figure drops, that be found somewhere by diverting monies that are already going to the public subsidy program. This is the administrative part. That's the giving out money part, and they both ought to be looked at together.
And I believe Senator Rust is going to be having some bills to put the board on a more stable funding stream, but Senator Rust?
Yeah, just briefly, and I know we have other agencies. The bill that I hope members will think about is to treat the Campaign Finance Board as an enterprise fund and to pay for all of its operations through the checkoff dollars. So that there's, at this point, there'd be a $700,000 savings to the general fund. And that's why I was asking about how much money there is. And so it would mean $700,000 less going to candidates, but it would, I think, from my point of view, be a very, very worthwhile to candidates to have assurances that we have a top-notch campaign finance board that is assuring us of that oversight and accountability for people that are getting the benefit of the public dollars is there, and that it would be a really worthwhile way to go. And maybe, you know, I'm sure there's some places in between of maybe the kinds of dollars that would come out of the public subsidy, if not the whole thing, but it would be carved out as an obligation of the public subsidy. An additional proposal that's probably will engender more debate is to make the checkoff an opt-out rather than an opt-in. So those two things will be coming forward for your discussion.
Different issue for a different day. Okay, anything further, Mr. Goldsmith?
Mr. Chair, members, just one other thing. The board looks at itself as a steward of these public monies, not only the public subsidy program, but certainly the part that is given to us for operating budget. I'm pleased to tell this committee, and I tell everybody that asks me, we were audited by the legislative auditor in November of 2007 for fiscal years 2005, 6, and 7. There were no findings or recommendations, and it was found that the board complied with all of the requirements and procedures that were appropriate for it.
Yes, and I thank you very much for that. We're going to be asking every single agency to provide us with not only the results of their latest audit, but if there were findings, what they've done to correct them.
Okay.
And it's wonderful that you had zero.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Goldsmith. Any questions from the campaign board? Well, thank you very much. And as I say, we'll have more further discussions about the filing issues and so forth later on when the bills get moving on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Okay.
Thank you, members.
The next item we have is the Office of Administrative Hearings. Judge? Welcome back to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I am Raymond Krause, and I'm the Chief Administrative Law Judge at the Office of Administrative Hearings. Today, I'm joined by Assistant Chief Bruce Johnson, Assistant Chief Bill Johnson, and our Court Administrator, Susan Schleisman. Very pleased to be able to report that this year we have had some significant developments in several areas, and I'll go through each one of those four areas that I think the committee would be interested in very quickly, and then be happy to take questions. First of all, in the Workers' Compensation Division, While the number of disputes that arrive at OAH for decision has continued to go up, we are still meeting the six-month deadline that we have set for ourselves and committed to the legislature on, where we will commit to schedule all hearings in 6 months or less, and we're well ahead of that. Also, we have had in the last year a significant demand from the workers' compensation bar to provide a service that we have not in the past, and that is mediation services. In some very complex cases, and in some cases where the parties feel that only a judge would be successful in completing a mediation, they have asked us to do this, and we have agreed to do it on an experimental basis. It's working quite well. The feedback from the bar is very, very positive, and we've been able to do that without increasing any judges by restructuring a little bit of our workload and asking everybody to put a little extra effort into it. We've been able to do the mediation in these select kinds of cases without any increase in staff. The other thing that we have been spending a good deal of time on, is working with the Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry to come up with ways to further streamline the workers' compensation process, our interaction with the Department of Labor, ways that between the two agencies we can eliminate bumps or steps in the process and make the whole workers' compensation dispute process somewhat simpler and hopefully less expensive. On the Administrative Law Division, happy to report that for the past 3 years, and including this year, we have not needed to increase our rates that we charge. That rate remains at $160 an hour, which is significantly lower than the average rate for Minnesota law firms charging for comparable experienced attorneys. The campaign case legislation from several years ago now continues to be very successful. We are meeting the tight deadlines for doing those cases before the election. And we've also created a database online which allows a lot of parties to look at that and see that some cases, some issues have already been decided, and so they don't need to file cases. Also, we've been keeping the cost of those hearings very low, and the result of that is a continued drop in the number of cases being filed on campaign practices. And we attribute that to those three pieces, that the turnaround time is quick, so the decision gets out before the election. A lot of the questions are already answered and on our database, and so we don't do the same case over and over again. And then the cost is not terribly expensive. Third piece from the administrative law perspective that I think is very reassuring to us that we are doing things right is that we have had a significant number of cities and counties requesting us to do hearings for them on a contract basis in the last year. And they have asked us to do everything from different kinds of land use cases to nuisance cases to things that were of a judicial nature, but they've now, the city has made them a civil penalty, and so they have asked us to hold those hearings. As a matter of fact, one city in the metropolitan area has asked us to provide a judge 2 days a month to do all their nuisance hearings. And they have found that for a number of reasons, it makes sense to use the Office of Administrative Hearings to do those hearings. One, again, the rate that we charge, $160 an hour, is much less than they are now paying for other people to hold those hearings. We're perceived as completely neutral and fair and not picked by the city council or the county board or anything else because we're friends or something. And we're timely. We get the cases done quickly and get a recommended decision back to the board or the council fairly quickly. So we're very pleased that the kind of service that we can provide has been recognized by municipalities and counties. So that we're increasing that portion of our business significantly.
And just to elaborate, Judge Krause, I mean, those nuisance hearings, those minor penalties, might otherwise have gone to the courts, right?
Absolutely, so, Mr. Chair.
So, I mean, we're hearing a lot of the pressure on the courts to try to, you know, figure out what they're going to do with their budget, and so this is an alternative. Of course, somebody's got to pay you to do it, but it is cheaper if some of these minor things can be sent to the administrative law process instead of having to go to a judge.
Mr. Chair, that's absolutely right. The cities that have approached us have said that it's is significantly cheaper in not only because our rates are low, but they have less time needed to be spent prepping the case and doing continuances and other things that the judicial system is requiring, whereas they can get it set very quickly with us. We don't have a backlog. We get them done, get them through, and it's quicker for them and cheaper for them. That's exactly the reason that they are approaching us, is that it provides that.
And in a different realm, of course, the courts spend a lot of time right now on, well, not a lot of time, but they have to handle these implied consent hearings, you know, where somebody's been picked up for drunken driving and they have a right to go to court and contest the revocation of the driver's license. Theoretically, that is something that could be sent over to an administrative law judge. However, it has to be paid for, correct?
That's correct, yeah. Mr. Chair. And in, I think it's 26 states now, implied consent hearings are done administratively by our counterpart in whatever state, the OAH of that state. Most of that funding in other states comes through federal highway trunk highway funds, or from their Department of Public Safety. But that's commonly what is done in other states, and yes, that is something that we could do and have talked about doing. Matter of fact, I believe several years ago now, the Finance Committee took a look at that and did a study of what it would take to do that.
Okay. Please proceed.
The last major point I wanted to make is about our move to St. Paul from Minneapolis. As you may remember, we moved to the Stassen building last year, and that was, in our view, an overwhelming success in many ways. First of all, the customers, the injured workers that come for our workers' comp hearings and all the other kinds of hearings that we do find it more convenient. They find it cheaper to get access to us, and particularly parking is less expensive. And they find it's a more customer-friendly facility than we had in Minneapolis. We have much better security and technology. We make much better use of the technology that's available. For example, in Minneapolis, we had all of our workers' comp cases. The judges had to do pre-hearings in person, which required everybody to come in and use a courtroom and sit down and do the pre-hearing, which is generally fairly short. But now we do them exclusively on the phone, and so the bar is happy because they don't have to come into our offices and spend the time, charge their client the extra amount for travel and sitting in our courtrooms. Our judges can do more hearings because they can just set them up on the phone and do them much more quickly. We also now have better capability for video conferencing, which helps us cut down on the travel costs of going out and holding hearings where we're not absolutely required to hold hearings. Some of the cases that we do, for example, special ed hearings, we're required by statute to hold the hearing in the school district. But for example, workers' compensation, we can do those by video conference if that's warranted. Also, we now have the capability in this new building to use digital recording as opposed to court reporters or our old system of tapes, which no one would fix them anymore, so we were down to our last three machines. So we're using digital recording, which, again, saves costs in the sense of using fewer court reporters and making a much clearer and better record. But beyond those, we have had a number of significant cost savings, and I want to take a little bit of time to go into this because I think it's something that may be useful for other agencies as well. When we moved to the Stassen building, we worked out an arrangement with the Department of Revenue to share services. And we, being a very small agency and they being a large agency, in a number of areas, we have been very successful in being able to share those share services, which has allowed us to get a better service at the same or less cost. And I'd like, if it's all right with the chairman, to ask Ms. Schleissman, our court administrator, to talk about that for just a minute.
Sure.
Because I think it's something, again, that might be helpful for other agencies to know about.
And while she's coming up, apparently it has worked out to move some of these agencies into the revenue building. However, then revenue didn't have enough space for some of their own people, and we had tax compliance employees, so then they had to go out, have them working outside the building. But that's that department's problem, not this one. It's working out for this agency, but revenue was a little surprised when they realized that they didn't have enough room for their own people. But as I say, that's their problem. Welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Susan Schleissman. I'm the court administrator at the Office of Administrative Hearings. And I'd like to tell you some good news about how shared services helped us, both in terms of relocation and our current position and the day-to-day operations for the OAH in the Stassen building. Shared services reduces our overhead simply and enhances our ability to provide services to our clients and customers and our employees. We've been able to reduce our costs by sharing space and services in the areas of business and financial management, security, technology, and communications. By relocating to St. Paul, we were able to reduce our annual lease space costs of $400,000 annually, or each for the first year. We also enjoy the full security that the Stassen building allows us, and we pay a percentage of the total security costs for the building operations as our fair share. And I think that's significant because in Minneapolis we had very limited security. And the costs of bearing the security operation in our hearing rooms and public and private space was very, very, very high. And in this way we're able to enjoy all of the services both in our public and private space, in our dock, our exits, and our entrances. Because we share infrastructure in the Stassen building, we're able to reduce our staffing needs and hold positions that become vacant, unfilled. In addition, we've been able to find savings in both mail, postage, and courier services, communications, library, copy center, training, digital signage, and just sharing public space with the Department of Revenue. In addition, we've been actively encouraged and do participate in committees within the building structure in the areas of information policy, diversity, technology. What we're able to do is improve our services both to our employees and our clients without adding new positions, duplicating functions, and creating new structures. And just finally, I'd like to say, although some of these dollar savings aren't huge amounts in terms of looking at numbers when we're looking at budget recommendations and that sort of thing, but we have been able to leverage our resources in many ways with the Department of Revenue. And just simply put, it's worked very, very well for us. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Schleissman. Any questions for her? Okay, Judge, anything further?
No, Mr. Chairman, just to, again, reiterate the one point I wanted make sure everyone heard it. We are to the special comp fund returning $300,000 a year approximately in rent savings, and that's our contribution as we saw it out of the move to pay back what this committee and other committees did in helping us get that move accomplished. So we thank you. And
now, I one question I've got. The governor, of course, is proposing a 5% reduction, which it looks on page 7 of our budget book's view area. It's about $15,000. It's my understanding, however, since you're in the unique situation where you bill your agencies and your clients for the work that you do, although you're getting a reduction here and some of the other savings you've had, this is not going to be a major factor for your operations. Is that a fair statement?
Mr. Chair, members, that's correct. That applies to our municipal boundary adjustment group, and that we have already found ways to accomplish the 5% cut with existing savings from salary savings and other things. So we have already found the way to do that and don't have a problem with that cut, no.
Thank you. Any further questions for the Office of Administrative Hearings? Senator Rest.
Yes, as I've indicated, I am going to be asking about the internal control audits by the OLA. And the latest one that I have a printed copy of was the one through June 30th of 2004, which should mean that there is a probably one that's either ongoing, but through June 30th of 2008. Usually there's a nine-month delay before we get a report. But I did notice that in the 2004 one, there was one finding, and it had to do with the deposits. As you know, the statutes say, or I'm sure it's in the statutes, that when there is $250 or more in a single day is collected, that the deposits must be made daily. And of the nine deposits that they sampled, two of yours failed that standard. One was a check of $2,000 or $3,000, and one was like $450. And we don't like to see repeat findings, of course, and I was wondering if that has been corrected. And, of course, the reason for it is not to be annoying. The reason for it is when a receptionist takes in cash and or a check and it sits around for a week, there is more opportunity for it to be stolen or misplaced than if it was deposited on a daily basis. And so can you assure us that finding will not be repeated in your next audit?
Judge Cross?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest and members, yes, we can. That's one of the wonderful byproducts of this move to the Stassen building. We're now sharing front desk services with the Department of Revenue, and as you may know, they have a cashier function at that front desk. So deposits now are not only deposited on the same day, but we have a separation of functions that we did not have because we did not have enough staff as a small agency before to do that. We now have the separation of functions as well as the daily deposits per the Department of Revenue's policy.
And Mr. Chairman, I also noticed that their conclusions with regard to payroll and operating expenditures that in the fiscal years 2001 and 2002, and I realize it's a long look back, but that's the way this, we don't have enough funds for them to audit you every year. That the OAH did not follow appropriate procurement and accounting practices for operating expenditures, but that they compliment you for having taken the necessary steps to strengthen, I'm reading from it, and improve those practices to an acceptable level. And it's that kind of thing that we do want to see, that when there are findings, that they're not dismissed and that they're not repeated. And so I compliment you on that.
Thank you, Senator Rest.
Anything further for the Office of Administrative Hearings? If not, well, thank you, Judge Krause, and we'll be seeing you down the road.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. The next item we have is the State Board of Investment. Mr. Baker. You have a section of the budget books that deals with the investment board. Welcome to the budget division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Howard Bicker. I'm the director of the State Investment Board. Hopefully I'll be shorter, gave you a little handout. For those of you that are not familiar, the Minnesota State Board of Investment has four board members. The governor is the chair. The other three members are the attorney general, the secretary of state, and the state auditor. I have an investment advisory council comprised of 17 members, 10 of which are from the local investment community. In addition to the Commissioner of Finance, the Director of the three statewide retirement systems, two active employees and one retiree that provide advice to both the staff and the board on investment-related policies. The third page of my handout shows you the assets under management. This is as of the end of the fiscal year, June 30th, 2008. The board was responsible for $59.4 billion. Most of which is retirement-related, but we do a number of other things for various organizations.
One question, Mr. Bicker, and Sarah Pappas actually asked me this question recently because she's new to the Pensions Commission. When the major pension funds have their funds, how much of the pension funds are there? We've got all these little funds that are out there. We've got the major funds and so forth. What kind of a breakdown do we have that goes through the state board as opposed to what they manage on their own?
Mr. Chairman, as far as assets under management, as of the end of the fiscal year, the retirement-related assets for the statewide funds at that point in time was about $46 billion.
For the major funds, do they put all of them within the state board, or do they retain some of their own investment opportunities and send some to you? Or is it all with you, or where does it go?
Mr. Chairman, they are all with us, the statewide plans. Again, there are some plans. St. Paul Teachers, Duluth Teachers continue to have their own programs from an investment standpoint. And there are some closed funds, MRF, and a couple of police and fire funds that still retain some investment authority.
And it's basically the smaller ones, then, that do not go through you.
That's correct,
Mr. Chairman.
The large
ones all go through you. Okay.
That's correct.
But thank you. Please proceed.
Starting on page four, and actually page five, is some investment results for the fiscal year that ended on June 30th. The board was down 5%. This is not a good year, although it's better than this year. And you can see that over longer periods of time, 5, 10, and 20 years, we have compounded at various numbers and have added value to inflation. And on the next page is
Mr.
our
Chairman.
Returns versus composite index.
Okay.
You can see since 1-1, excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
Sir Pappas, sir.
Mr. Chairman, just to slow you down a little bit, Mr. Bicker. So how's it looking so far in 2009? What are you anticipating the drop will be?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Pappas, through the end of the fiscal calendar year, excuse me, for the first 6 months of this fiscal year, we were down approximately 23%. In January, the stock market was down another 8%. Now, the entire plan won't be down 8%, and actually in February, we've seen early parts of February, there's been some rebound. But it's been a bad market. I think everybody is well aware of what's going on, and obviously people on your side and on my side are very much watching what's going on in Washington and Wall Street to see what response we're going to have to this financial issues that we are facing.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Sarah Pappas,
and members, I have good news to report that I think the economy is coming back because I sold my house 2 weeks ago.
Congratulations. And how long was it on the market?
15 months.
Okay. And Mr. Bicker, you know, you also presented something to the Pension Commission about how you avoided hedge funds and so forth. So as part of your presentation, could you just talk about some of the principles that have guided the state board investment in your investments as well, too. So,
well, Mr. Chairman and members, we think the State Board of Investment runs a pretty progressive investment program but we are not what you would call out on the edge. We have not done hedge funds. We have not leveraged our portfolio. We have not done what I call the flavor of the month. A lot of people chase the new hot idea, and you know that may work out for a while, but in the long run, the only people that make money on that tends to be brokers. We have a lot of discipline in place in the sense that we rebalance our portfolio. We move back to various asset allocations that we've established over longer periods of time. And we just don't make bets. We stick to our knitting. I guess we've been called stodgy, kind of old-fashioned. But we think that has served the state well. But we still are not what I would call in the dark ages. I mean, we have a pretty good equity exposure. We have been in private equity and alternative investments for a long time and have done the state very, very well. We have had very, very good returns on those asset classes over longer periods of time. But we have not spent a lot of time chasing new fads, and we think that the program, although it's had good years and bad years, net has done pretty well.
And I know you've got some more points to make, but there's a couple things that come to mind, too. When you're talking about the overall amount that you've got, obviously the retirement funds are something that's just fenced off and so forth, but when you're talking about state cash accounts and permanent school funds, that is part of the budget, is it not, that the legislature has to prepare for the next biennium? And so if the investments are going down, that has a direct impact, doesn't it, on some of the assumptions we have to make in proceeding with the state's budget?
Mr. Chairman, the state cash accounts are very conservatively invested and have not gone down in value. If I had to come and report to you that we've lost money out of the general revenue fund, I do not think a lot of people would be very happy. And we reinvest that money very conservatively. Interest rates are very low, so we are not making a lot of money on it. I mean, you have a six-month treasury bill yielding 0.02% right now. But it's still positive, and those assets, although are not earning a lot of money, have not lost money. The permanent school fund and some of the other funds will have some effect. I believe the legislature passed a law last year where now the earnings from the permanent school fund will be used as a budgetary item where historically they were an offset to school aids. Now, that is going to be interest and dividends. So even though the market value may have gone down, the interest and dividends on the securities, for the most part, will not have gone down significantly, although some equities are reducing their dividends or even eliminating dividends. Another fund that will have some impact from a legislative standpoint is the Environmental Trust Fund, because a portion of the Environmental Trust Fund is used by the legislature in spending for various environmental issues throughout the state. But as far as the general fund, we continue to earn money on that. Obviously, if the markets don't recover in a year or two or three, there may be some financial ramifications as it relates to the pension plans in the long run.
Okay. I interrupted you. Do you have some other things further that you
Mr. Chairman, members, really, I don't have much more. If you just look at page 7, last page, the State Board has a general fund request of $151,000. The majority of our budget, which is slightly over $2.6 million, we bill back to those entities for which we invest money, which obviously the majority of our budget is billed back to the retirement systems for which we invest money. The $151,000 is to invest the state's money, right? State's general revenue.
And so the governor is recommending basically just no cuts or anything, just giving you the $151 million that you need to administer the funds.
$151,000.
$1,000.
5% of that is not enough to balance the budget. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Yeah.
However, the total amount that you have is twice, about twice what the overall biennial budget is. You've got $60 billion, mm-hmm. and our state budget for a biennium is $34 billion. So. Okay, any questions, Mr. Bicker and the State Board of Investment? Senator Russ.
I would compliment your office on having a clean audit in terms of internal controls for the year ended June 30th of 2007. Is your office audited every year, or are you on a rotation as well?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Rest, I think they're there all the time.
They're there. Good.
it is every
obviously
year.
Obviously, when you don't have any findings, that's what we like to hear. Thank you very much, Mr. Bicker.
Mr. Bicker, the bill that was heard in state government operations on the investments in Iran is going to be, I think, at a point the Pensions Commission is going to look at. We might have to circle back, depending upon what the Pension Commission wants to do, and look at it here, too. So at some point, I may have to have you talking about that, certainly at the Pension Commission, if not here again. So, okay.
That'd be fine, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members.
Any other questions of him? Okay. Then we have actually the four retirement accounts here, and if they would all want to come up at the same time, it'll because it's we have some common issues here for the Minnesota State Retirement System, Public Employees Retirement Account, the Teacher Retirement Account, and the Minneapolis Entirers Retirement Account. Now, the books originally had only the MSRS. We've had some subsequent handouts for the members that should be in front of you for your book. So, the very last tab, it says, well, excuse me, the last tab says retirement accounts, but the only thing that we had up until today was Minnesota State Retirement System. We passed out the teacher's retirement and the public employee's retirement, so you should have separate ones that would also go in your book later on. So, Mr. Bergstrom, or who wants to go first?
Mr. Chair, good afternoon. My name is Dave Bergstrom, and I'm the director of the Minnesota State Retirement System. Just a very quick overview of MSRS. We administer six defined benefit programs, the largest of which is our General Employees Retirement Plan. Most of our plans are funded through employee and employer contributions. MSRS also administers the Unclassified Plan, which is a defined contribution plan that legislators elected after 1997 are participants, your staff are participants, plus agency heads. We also administer a voluntary deferred compensation plan, the Minnesota Deferred Compensation Plan, that is not only just for state employees, it's actually a plan that city, county, school, and all public employees can participate in. That plan currently has 80,000 participants and over $3 billion. One of the things that we are doing right now is we have hired a new record keeper, which will cost us about $1 million a year less. We will be lowering participant fees from 0.1% down to 0.0007%. That plan is funded solely through participant fees. So we'll be able to lower fees for members of our deferred comp plan. We also administer the healthcare savings plan. That too is funded through participant fees. We currently are collecting 0.65%, a little over one half of 1%. That plan was created in 2001 and has grown markedly to 50,000 participants. So that plan has been very successful. We paid out about $27 million in reimbursement claims last year for health care expenses. And that one as well is funded through participant fees. The FTEs on the budget page for MSRS are wrong. We actually have 88 FTEs. I'm not sure what happened in the translation. Two of those are handling the human resource duties for all three of the statewide pension plans. We carry them on our system because they are state employees and paying into our retirement fund. We have three vacant FTEs right now. Of those 88, we have three vacant. We are leaving those vacant as well as we prepare our 2010 fiscal year budget to present to the board. The appropriation that we are asking for is to fund elected state officers, constitutional officers. That is a pay-as-you-go plan and has been a pay-as-you-go plan since its existence. And legislators, after that start collecting after the beginning of fiscal year 03, I believe it was, are also pay-as-you-go. In essence, you give us an appropriation, and we put it in a check and send it to the participant. So we are asking for, it's included in the governor's rec, $1,666,000 in 2010, $1,671,000 in 2011. And that is the request that we...
And that's, as I'm looking at page 5, it says expenditures by category. It says... Is that it says total compensation, and so the number goes up in 10 and 11, and that's what you're referring to, the cost of the constitutional officers and the old legislators' plan? That okay.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Gotcha. Okay. Okay. All right.
Mr. Chairman.
Sarah Pappas.
Shouldn't we have that request, a budget page on there?
No, we don't have it.
I'm not finding it. Do you see it?
No.
What?
See it on the computer. We'll check it.
6 and 7. Okay, we don't have it.
All right. Don't we have?
I have
Senator Pappas, Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas, what don't we have?
Well, usually there's a sheet that says what the budget request is. And Mr. Bergstrom just said they were requesting 1.7 million, and I don't see that.
We've got the recommendation from the governor. We don't see what the agency had requested.
Well, I don't see the recommendation from the governor.
No.
That's what I don't see.
We have that. It's five and six.
Yeah, page 5 shows what the governor's recommending.
All right. Governor recommends. Okay.
My page change item.
Why don't you get on the mic?
Yeah. Okay, thanks.
Ms. Lonergan's got the information here. So,
the governor's office never provided us with a change item or a recommendation form for it. Oftentimes you'll see change item operating budget reductions. The governor's office, from what we had on the computer we printed off from MMB's site, never provided us with the change item.
So it's just within the budget
Yeah, we don't have any type of record on that besides what's on page 5.
Thank you.
Now, one other thing that we should be talking about, and again, the Pension Commission is probably more attuned to this, but the fact last year we did have the bill that I carried in the pension bill that said that if the stock market went under 80%, the active fund, which is the current employees, and they make their contributions and the employer make the contributions and it's invested, would merge with the post fund, that is the retirees. And Mr. Bergstrom and the other pension fund, could you just comment on the status of that so that at least people who are now the Pension Commission are aware of what's going on there?
Mr. Chair, the bill essentially, if the post fund fell below 80%, we each took back our share of those retiree assets and merged them with our active funds. As of June 30th, the post fund did fall below 80%. It was just 79.7%. So we are in the process of unwinding that post fund for retirees, pulling them back into our active fund, and that will be completed by the end of this fiscal year. So we have stopped making new contributions to the post-retirement fund, and we're going through that accounting change as we speak.
Yes, sir. Olsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Under the governor's recommendation for healthcare savings in the next biennium, that's zeroed. Is that just because we don't know what the contributions are going to be, or?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olsen, the reason that's zero, that is actually moving offline to a record keeper as well. So all of those plans that are zeroed out will now be handled by an outside record keeper. We have been doing this record keeper on the healthcare savings plan on monthly valued funds internally, and it's just to the point, quite frankly, of killing us. So we now, as part of the new record keeper, they're going to be handling it, so now it will fall outside of the state's accounting system.
I'll follow up if I
may. Seen.
Then up there where it says expenditures by category, under total compensation, that's going up in the governor's budget. I was interested in that.
Yeah, that as we mentioned, the constitutional officers and the legislators elected through 1990, up to 1997. What used to happen was that the legislature had appropriate money every year to fund those retirements since 97, legislators since 97, and those legislators who decided to opt into it now have, you know, you legislators, you and me, by the way, you pay part of your paycheck and it's paid by the employer so that the legislature doesn't have to appropriate money every year down the road to pay for the legislators' funds. We still have to pay for it for the constitutional officers and for those legislators that are on the old retirement plan. So we still have to make that funding every year. So that's what that represents, is the money that we have to pay in every year for the old legislators' plan and not old legislators, the former previous legislators' plan and the constitutional officers. They're all old legislators, though, by the way. So, okay. Anything else from MSRS? Okay. The rest.
Well, Mr. Chairman, once again, go. I'm pleased to report that the internal control audit from the OLA for the year ended June 30th of 2007 was an unqualified audit, no findings. Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Vanek, PERA. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, Mary Vanek, PERA. I do have a handout if okay. You could make it available.
And PERA is for the local government employees, whereas Mr. Bergstrom had the state employees. So these are the local employees.
Public Employees Retirement administers three defined benefit plans for local government and one defined contribution plan, which is primarily participated in by local government elected officials. We receive no general fund appropriations whatsoever, so anything that refers to a direct appropriation in the budget document is not funded. It's not money coming to us from the general fund. We are funded within our structure. We thought that perhaps if we put it in a chart, in pie chart form, it'd be a little bit easier to digest the numbers. Our estimated revenues for 07 through 2011, or actual and then estimated through 2011, are in the top chart. Through fiscal 08, we can still say that 70% of our revenue was generated through investment returns. I imagine we're not going to be able to say that when we complete this fiscal year, but the lion's share of our funding comes through the investment returns on the employee and employer contributions we collect. And then the expenditures that you see in your budget document are actually benefit payments primarily. That's 94% of the money that we spend is directly to the benefit recipients of the three plans we administer. 3% of that money is in refunds to people who don't take benefits, and they get their contributions plus interest returned to them when they ask for that. 1% of our expenditures is related to our administrative budget. On the next page, we just wanted to give you a little sense of our staffing complement. The budget document shows about 86, 87 people. We actually have allocations for 94. We've recently filled two or three of those positions, but we still have, I believe, four positions vacant. And as part of the cost-cutting measures going forward, we will be talking to the board about not filling at least two, perhaps three of those positions. The scatter chart in the middle is just to give you an idea. PERA is able to run with a staff ratio of over 3,100 to per member, or 3,000 per each member, compared to the national average of 1,500 per member, because we have a lot of long-term, very knowledgeable, qualified staff. But given the age cohort and years of service, we're going to be losing those people. So we are going to be very concerned about teaching people about PERA staff, new staff people, and making sure that we have knowledgeable staff to serve our members. And then at the bottom of the chart is the contributions in place. Our regular plan contributions are currently member 6% and employer 6.75%, and the employer will go up to 7% on January 1st. Police and Fire Fund is at 9.4 for members, 14.1 for employers. And the correctional plan, which is the healthiest plan at 100% funded currently, those contribution rates have been in place since it was initially authorized by the legislature in 1999.
It goes beyond the scope of what we're doing here, but some of the members may be aware that I believe the governor's made a proposal on correction employees that over the years in the Pension Commission, we've tried to identify those employees that have regular contact with inmates or dangerous persons or whatever, and apparently the governor is, or is that you're Mr. Bergstrom, trying to move some of those out of that plan. And again, it goes beyond what we're doing here. It's something the Pensions Commission is going to have to look at. But did you want to comment briefly on that, Mr. Bergstrom?
Mr. Chair, just briefly, it has to do with our correctional plan. Prior to 1996, the correctional plan was for uniformed security officers, guards, et cetera. And then in 1996, since 1996, they've been adding nurses, teachers, and other folks that have 75% inmate contact. So what the budget proposal that is being offered by the Department of Corrections would be to eliminate, for pension coverage purposes, that group from the correctional plan and move them into our general employees retirement plan. So the group that they're talking about does have inmate contact. It's a process that they will use to lower their contribution rates. The correctional plan has higher benefits in early retirement, therefore it has a higher cost to it.
And as I say, it's a different budget division, but you know, we have the oversight over your budget and so forth, and members are going to be hearing about this, you know, through your constituents and so forth. So just be aware that the thing is out there. So any questions, Ms. Vanek? You're also affected by the stock market and so forth, and the merger of the two funds. Any particular issues on the horizon that you know you want to discuss here, as opposed to in the Pension Commission, or what's?
No, Mr. Chair.
We're both places. So
we are similarly situated as the other funds. Mr. Bickard reported that the market returns are down 23% as the end of the calendar year, so we will directly be affected by that. The one thing I did want to note, that there is reference in the budget document to other post-employment benefits. The legislature authorized PERA to be a trust administrator and record keeper of assets invested through the state board by local government to pay for their retiree health care costs. We currently have 17 entities who have now worked through us to invest their money with the State Board of Investment to the tune of about $140 million. Although there is some reference in the document of expenditures, there have been no expenditures out of any of those trusts. That money has just recently been deposited for investment so that local government has money to pay their retiree health expenses. And with respect to the other issues facing us, we, of course, are interested in talking to the Pension Commission about the latest newspaper report that the City of Minneapolis and the MRF Board are very interested in merging both, not only MRF, but the public safety plans for Minneapolis with the police and fire and the general plan and para. So that will be much discussion going forward.
After the Pension Commission gets done with that, then it comes through the legislative process, the GovOps Committee, and so forth. So, okay, thank you. Next, we have a teacher's retirement. Center Rust. Oops, I forgot.
My
yes.
Little report
yes.
Here.
although, report card.
And again, the little report card here. PERA got an unqualified opinion on their financial statements. They were not so fortunate to do that on an information technology audit, which was done at the same time. And there were some six findings, two of which were prior findings that were only partially resolved. Unfortunately, in the document that I brought down, I only have the recommendations and the findings and not the agency response, which is included. But I wonder if you could assure us the degree to which those six findings, which is a lot of findings, it's a lot, it's a big number, that they have been resolved.
Ms. Vanek.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rust, we continue to work on the IT issues that were discovered. This was our second go-around with an IT audit through the Office of the Legislative Auditor. And a number of things that were brought to our attention were things that we are continuing to work on. We have added an additional person in our security, the network security operations that we engage in. And we did file exceptions on a couple of those findings. We are a service organization, and I know that they have concerns about the number of people who can change information for our benefit recipients. We take a lot of calls, and we rotate those phone calls throughout our pension services division, and we want to readily be able to serve our members. Now, with that being said, we are working on opportunities for benefit recipients to go online and make those changes themselves, and we are looking at putting in a front-end phone system so we only route those calls to a handful of individuals, which would then we would take away rights to other people to make changes. So we are working on things. We continue to work with our security folks and have discussions with the folks at the Office of the Legislative Auditor on our IT issues.
Mr. Chairman, I, for one, am going to follow this. And I will expect that the next time there's an IT audit that there are no findings, and that your, the findings from the auditor are not pulled out of the sky, and they are not, when they talk about obeying state law or obeying government-accepted accounting principles, they're really not a matter of choice. And we really do expect agencies, large and small, to do the best they can. We don't always – we love to see zero. We don't expect perfection. We know that occasionally there's going to be a finding. But, for example, sending non-public files to the OET unencrypted is not acceptable. You know? You can't do that. So I hope that that doesn't come back. Do you get these audits every year? And I noticed that the prior one, there were five findings there, or six findings, and five of those had been resolved. How often do they do an IT audit?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, I'm not sure that they have a regular schedule yet. They used us, I believe, as kind of a testing ground with their initial audit of the public retirement systems. And they did come back around to do an additional audit with us. We do take these audit findings very seriously, Senator Rest. I want you to be assured of that. Our financial audit is
clean
and impeccable.
Congratulations.
But there are a lot of things related to automation that, yes, we need to continue to make improvements on. But, again, we will continue to work with them and hope that we can come to some meeting.
Thank you very much,
okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions of PERA? Okay, the next item we have the teachers' retirement account. These are all the teachers in the state except for those in the St. Paul or Duluth teachers. They do include the Minneapolis teachers that a few years ago, when that fund was basically failing, had to be rolled into TRA. So Ms. Hackett and Mr. Thompson, welcome to the Budget Division.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a
one. You'll need to identify yourself for the record, too. So.
Yes. Laurie Hacking, Director of the Teachers Retirement Association. What I'm handing out is just an update of TRA's profile that you, I believe, have in front of you, an update to show the more recent fiscal year numbers. TRA serves just about 160,000 K-12 teachers, as well as some MNSCU faculty. We have seen significant increase in our membership, particularly among our retiree ranks, if you look at our numbers over the past decade. There are 580 employers reporting to TRA, and that includes school districts as well as MNSCU, as I said, and charter schools. Our covered payroll, that's the payroll upon which we collect contributions, is at $3.64 billion annually. And our contribution rates are 5.5% for the member as well as the employer. Our value of assets as of the end of 2008 were just over $18 billion. Our liabilities, a bit higher than that, $22.2 billion, leaving us with a funding ratio of 82%. And I might just interject here that we are... have met with some legislators and are starting to try to reach out to as many as we can to explain TRA's financial situation and that we are likely to need, not likely, we do need a contribution rate increase in the future. The market downturn has hit us very hard, and as Mr. Chair, you referred to the merger of the post fund into the active fund, TRA had approximately half of the liabilities and from the post fund and the deficit, and that hit us pretty hard, and that along with the market downturn has put us in a disadvantageous position. So in order to stay on track for full funding, we are going to be looking for a contribution increase in the future. We are doing it so that there is some advance warning and are asking for it to be effective in July 2011. That is outside of the current biennium, but we want to inform everyone and let people understand what the fiscal consequences of that might be in the future.
Just in case maybe people hadn't really appreciated what you just explained to us, first of all, I've got the bill that was introduced today, and contribution increase means the school districts are going to have to pay more, which is going to come out of their budgets unless the legislature provides additional money to cover that. It also means the teachers are going to have to pay more for their own retirement, and a lot of them are not happy with the idea of paying more for the benefits, you know, paying more and getting the same benefits. So they're concerned about that. So this is but if we do nothing, then the fund gets in bigger trouble down the road. So Senator Rubley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, if the markets turn around, how long can you wait, and to what level of funding ratio can you go to before you insist upon an increase in the contributions? Historically, you've probably seen some downturns in the market and revenues not coming in as expected, but things have turned around and sometimes far exceeded your wildest expectations, as they probably did in the 90s. So how do you make that decision?
Ms. Hacking.
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, very good question. There is some hope that there will be a rebound. However, our deficit or deficiency is so large at this point that our actuary has basically said the chances of a rebound taking care of our entire deficiency are very small. So we feel, to be prudent fiduciaries, that we need to be upfront that we believe we need contribution increases. What we are proposing in the legislation that the chair is sponsoring for us is an automatic stabilizer mechanism, which basically says that if there is a rebound and we don't need to increase contribution rates in the future as much as we are projecting, then those increases blink off, basically. They would not be needed. Conversely, if we don't get a rebound, or hopefully this doesn't happen, markets deteriorate even further, there is, under the stabilizer provision, the potential for contribution rates to go up further. So I think that's a very good question. We have had, in every other downturn that we have experienced, we have had rebounds that have helped take care of the funding problem. But in some cases, TRA's case in the early 80s, we actually needed a contribution rate increase to help us get out of the hole that we were in. So it was a combination of extra revenue through contributions and a rebounding market that got us back on track for full funding.
Yeah, and it's more than just the market, because I think what happened was, you know, I mean, as an example, the rule of 90, I mean, legislators or teachers up until 1989 got to retire. Some of them maybe a bit too early, but they did. And bless them, they're living longer. They're healthier, but the longer that they live, the more the drain it is, because the retirees don't contribute anything anymore. Mm-hmm. And so there's a big drain that's going on the funds that even if the market rebounds, you still got to factor all that in. There's a number of factors, but, you know, there's a number. Ms. Hacking, and then Senator Roebling?
Yes, that's very true. There are a lot of factors. Fortunately, up until this decade, the biggest factor that has helped us has been very, very positive markets. And that got all, actually all three systems were benefited from that, but now we are seeing the downside of the markets, and that is hurting us.
And even the rebounding doesn't solve the problem. Senator Roebling, yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did the contribution rates for the employers and the members go up just a couple of years ago when the, wasn't it when the Minneapolis Teachers Fund was merged with this one? Or how recently did we increase the rate?
Ms. Hacking.
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, yes, the contribution rates went up in 2006, 2007. They were at 5% employee and employer, and they went up to 5.5, so just marginally. But historically, the rates have been much higher, particularly the employer rate that you see of 5.5% was as high as 9% throughout most of the 1980s. Again, because we had a deficit at that time, the legislature fortunately enacted larger increases, fairly large increases in contribution rates, and that helped us get back on track for full funding. As a result of the success in the markets and those higher contributions, we actually attained full funding in the late 1990s, in 1997, and that's when rates were set at 5% for the employer as well as the employee.
It was a bit of a balancing act because obviously TRA was assuming some liabilities in taking on the Minneapolis fund and also to have to increase the contributions to pay for it. And we made an adjustment in the benefits, there are still TRA members, throughout the state, particularly in Greater Minnesota, they still are upset by the fact that they took on Minneapolis liabilities, but there was no choice at the time. So, but that was all part of a package that we had to do. Senator Pappas?
Mr. Chairman and Ms. Hacking, in the handout from the Finance Administration, it says that TRA has a funded status of 87.5% as of 2007. In your handout, you say the funding ratio is 82%. Is that change as a result of the merger with the Minneapolis Employees Retirement Fund, or are there other reasons for reduction?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, actually the finance handout is the data is 1 year old. Mm-hmm. So what I handed out was as of 2008, the end of June 30th, 2008. So the downturn, the drop in that funding ratio was really due to the market.
Due to the market.
Yeah. Okay. And might add that because of the very negative returns that we're experiencing in the current fiscal year, you'll most likely see those funding ratios go down again, unfortunately.
Yes, sir, Roebling.
Thank you. The payments to retirees, do they automatically go up every year? Or in a year when everything else is frozen or decreasing, is there any provision that those payments could be frozen or decreased as well?
Ms. Hacking, the cost of living increase and so forth?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, as of current law, our retiree increases are set at 2.5% per year. And that's that was something that was arrived at when the post-fund legislation was put through last year. That new legislation erased what was old law provisions that allowed retirees to share in some of the investment gains that we had in prior years. But that provision was really eliminated, and only the 2.5% increase going forward is allowed. And that is set in state statute and is in the nature of a guarantee. Our retirement systems, our boards looked at that and really got legal advice that we could not do anything really less than 2.5%.
And we've actually capped off the cost of increases because it's not fair to give generous increases when the economy is good and then say, well, we can't give any increases when the economy is bad. I mean, you should be able to give them whether it's good or bad, but that we had to cap off in the good times. But unfortunately, we did that after the good times ended. But
right.
Anyway, Sarah.
So Roebling. Mr. Chairman, that's both a ceiling and a floor.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair,
yeah. Sarah Roebling.
I did have a bill to do it when the good times were good, but it wouldn't
It didn't happen.
It didn't happen. So that was frustrating.
I had foresight, so okay.
But I you know, the 2.5, I suppose it is a cost of living about, but it is almost unrealistic today when other salaries and returns on investments are in the negative, that we have guaranteed a continuous 2.5% increase doesn't necessarily make sense in today's economy.
And these are just the major funds. We've got plenty of other pension funds that, you know, again, they do their own investments that raise some issues on their cost of living increases too. So it's a huge issue. We're just about out of time. Any other questions on TRA? I'm sorry, rest.
TRA got an unqualified audit.
Okay.
Congratulations.
The last one we've got is MRF, and that is a closed fund. That is, I mean, there aren't any new members coming in, but for a number of years, the legislature has had to appropriate money for this fund, and there's some legislative proposals dealing with the Minneapolis Employees Retirement Fund. Mr. Thompson, did you want to deal with that, sir?
Thank you, Chairman and members. And just to clarify, I still work at TRA. I am the executive director of MRF on a part-time basis, and that's resulted in an 11% reduction in the budget over there. So that's the good news. The second part of this is that even though the MRF board has responsibility for investing the money, all of the assets were transferred over to the state board in October. The state board of investment now has the management of those assets. And when I was hired in November, at the November meeting and at the December board meeting, the board adopted a resolution to merge. I have a copy of the resolution here to hand out to members. And the MRF board has gone on record saying that they request the legislature in this session consolidate MRF into PERA no later, or having an effective date, no later than June 30th of 2010. MRF, as Chairman Betzold has noted, is a closed fund. But more importantly than that, it is essentially a closed post fund now. The three major funds merged their post fund into the active fund with the post-run reforms of the last legislative session. MRF now is the only remaining pension fund out there that has a post-retirement fund. MRF has been part of the combined post fund at one time, starting in 78, but in 82, at that point, they transferred all of the money back out to MRF. All of the new coordinated members or new employees after 78 were put into PERA, and all of the basic members were left with MRF. The difference is that a basic member is not coordinated with Social Security, and for most of those do not have Medicare benefits. The funding for MRF as of June 30th, 2008, was approximately 76%. At that time, MRF had about $1.6 billion in liabilities, $1.2 billion in assets. As of June 30th, 2008, because of the market, the value of those assets was about $850 million. So they have about a 55% funding ratio. The critical thing for MRF is that they have a negative cash outflow. They do not have, you know, a large active member payroll. There's approximately 184 remaining active members that have all qualified for retirement, but for one reason or another have chosen to continue working, primarily for, I would expect, because of medical care insurance. MRF does get $9 million a year from the state. This was instituted in 1978. It was capped the latest time in 1997 at $9 million. That number had fluctuated from about $12 million to $3 million. As late as 2006, that $9 million only represented 20% of what the statutory contributions were to MRF. As of June 30th, 2008, that $9 million represents approximately two-thirds of the statutory contributions coming into MRF. That's statutorily, we need the statutory contributions about $16 million a year. $9 million of that comes from the state, and that's critical. That goes till 2020. You have a copy of the resolution of the MRF board before you, suggesting or requesting that MRF be consolidated into PARA no later than June 30th, 2010. Any questions?
Just a comment. Since it's been a closed fund, the legislature's had a standing appropriation for it every year. And, of course, every year legislators have kind of skimmed some of that money off, saying, well, we don't need to fund MRF right now because it's a closed fund, and now the bills are coming due. So that's what's happened over the years. So. But again, the Pension Commission will be dealing with some of those issues later on, and we'll see it as the bill comes forward. So any questions about MRF? If not, we'll thank you, members, and we'll see you Wednesday. What's on Wednesday's agenda?
The lottery.
Capital area board.
And gambling control.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll see you Wednesday. Thank you very much.